Part of Thursday. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Molloy program. Have you been following this ridiculous polling? What's his name? Rick Perry is now way in the lead. The really crazy, crazy man has a double-digit lead over poor old Mitt Romney. Romney's problem. You know, Romney at one time was, although he was bland and kind of pointless, his position on so many issues were in alignment with the position of most progressives, the so-called social issues. Other issues, he was more of a fiscal conservative, but he was a social liberal. And at one time, had he not been so wimpy, so colorless, so... Every time I see Mitt Romney, he just reminds me of a piece of spaghetti that's been overcooked, you know? Not even al dente, just overcooked. It just, oy, come on. But Romney is fading fast, and I think the reason is he has tried to put himself so far to the right to scoop up the psychopath vote that Michelle Bachmann had nailed down, but now Rick Perry is just glomming up left and right. It's really, really kind of a shame. To see all this happen, it is. I mean, I've always been interested in politics in this country. It has only been in the past maybe 8 or 10 years that I realized that the religious right and the political right and the capitalist right had co-conspired consciously and deliberately to destroy the country. And with no regrets, no regrets at all. The religious right is going along with it because they know that once this country is destroyed and the world sinks into chaos and bloodshed, that'll bring their Redeemer back. So that's the big news for them. The more earthquakes and tornadoes and blood and death and murder and mayhem and wars and rumors of wars that they can stir up through their action or inaction, the happier they will be, because that's what their religion is based on. It's based on death, destruction, and chaos. And as far as the political right is concerned, they are fascist down to the core. Fascism and religious fascism, political and religious fascism get along pretty well together. Primarily because the political fascists know that the religious fascists aren't going to do anything to overthrow the government or revolt, because the religious fascists are just waiting, you know, until the pile of bodies is big enough that the Redeemer will come back or whoever. And then, of course, you have the economic fascists, the capitalists. They kind of watch the religious fascists and the political fascists kind of balance each other out in a war against everything liberal and progressive. And while those two factions are busy blaming mainstream media and gay marriage and everything else on all the world's woes, the economic fascists continue to steal and loot and pillage and take until the day comes when there's nothing left to take. So, that's kind of where we're at. And to see Mitt, I can't get past his name, to see Mr. Romney, I kind of liked his old man. I remember his dad, George Romney, who was... he was the head of, what, General Motors, I think, at one time. He was a real capitalist, real industrialist type, wealthy in Michigan. And he was governor of Michigan, decided to run for the presidency on the Republican ticket in, what, 68? He was going to run in 68. He made a trip to Vietnam. And he came back from Vietnam, and he said that everything that Or was it 64? Was it 64 or 68? Hell, I don't remember. I'm sure somebody will correct me if it wasn't 68. But he came back from his trip to Vietnam, and he said that he realized that everything he had been told by the government and the media in this country was a lie. Not only was it a lie, but Romney, that's when he used the famous statement that he had been brainwashed in his own country. Well, that ended his political career. You cannot tell the truth if you ascribe to higher office. What you do is tell lies. If your base is liberal and progressive, you tell lies that will get them out to the polls and bring their mamas and daddies and aunties and cousins and nieces and nephews and everybody, you know. Hope and change, woohoo! If you are a right-winger, then your base is just basically psychopathic, then you tell the lies that it's necessary to get them out. You know, the queers are going to take over. The first thing you know, they'll be able to remove your preacher from the pulpit and place a homosexual man there or a lesbian woman. There are just so many problems that have been caused by the liberal media. We have to replace liberal media. We have to have a USA Patriot Act. The Russians are coming. The Muslims are coming. Hate this. Hate that. And by playing to, you know, the progressive lying to his base, I shouldn't say progressive, but real progressives don't lie. The Democrat lying to his base, the Republican lying to his or her base, and what are you left with? A political system that is as useless as, you know, I want to say tits on a bull, but I'm not supposed to say that word, I guess. So that's where we are. That's where we are. And to watch what happened with Barack Obama, and then to watch what happened in this Republican field. I mean, even John Huntsman has sold out to the right wing. Who'd have thought, right? Everybody knew that fascism was only a fingernail deep in the soil of the country. We all knew that. That's been known since way back at the beginning of the last century, or the century before the last. The last century. I'm trying to say the 19th, damn it. Okay, the 20th. Everybody knew at the beginning of the 20th century that fascism was just right below the surface. Political fascism, economic fascism, and especially religious fascism. Everybody knew it that had a brain. And we spent an entire century fending it off. Time and time and time again. Whether it was prohibition, whether it was the Depression, whether it was the United States involving itself in the foreign affairs or the affairs of other countries, whether it was seeking out and precipitating massive global wars, no matter what it was, the fascists had a field day. But they never quite got control. Until now. Until now, where the political system is rendered just completely useless. You know it as well as I do. You can, like a lot of folks, continue to kid yourself that the voting machines really, really, really record what America wants in all the various precincts. You can tell yourself that those days when the precincts are locked on voting day and somebody says, oh, well, I got sick, I forgot the key. Or those days when the registrar's office knows there are going to be 500 people an hour show up a precinct, and therefore we're going to put 3 voting machines in there. You can tell yourself that all that stuff is just pure coincidence. Go ahead. But the voting system, the way we select our leaders in this country, has been broken and smashed into a billion pieces. And the people who did the smashing were the capitalists. They knew. I mean, capitalism does not like democracy. Oh, my God. Anybody who tells you that capitalism and democracy thrive side by side is either thinks you're a moron or they are. It does not. Capitalism thrives and grows and metastasizes in a fascist state. In fact, that's what capitalism is. Just another name for fascism. Call it social Darwinism, call it whatever you want. But in a capitalist society, if you're not in the top 1%, eventually you're doomed. Very simple. Some of them want-
Yeah, the spotlight.
Mike, do it for you.
21 past the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Clark Morgan. Thank you, Clark. There's no message, just his sponsorship. We appreciate it very much. If you'd like to be a sponsor of an hour of this program, go to MikeMalloy.com. And there's all sorts of ways that you can contribute to the program to keep us on the air. It is up to you. Betsy writes in, Mike, I'm currently unemployed Texas educator. Thanks, Rick Perry. 10 years ago, I was a mentor teacher. That's like a school administrator, but at a teacher salary, at a Texas middle school. Over a few a several-week period, I heard complaints from the teachers about a certain sixth grader who was caught stealing food from the eighth grade lunch period and coming to class late. After the second or third complaint, I asked whether anyone knew if the family had food. No one had thought to ask or check. Turned out they didn't. The family didn't. I found it very odd that none of the teachers had considered that he might be stealing because of hunger and not because he was a troublemaker. 10 years later, I can't imagine a teacher who wouldn't think of hunger first. God bless America. Betsy, isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? Robert Reich doesn't have anything organized, but he, in his blog today, he said this Labor Day we need protest marches rather than parades. Yeah. You know, I think it's been the past, what, Kathy, about 10 years that we usually work on Labor Day. We'll be working this Labor Day. And I never know what to say, what to do. I mean, years ago, I used to get all, you know, verklempt about the power of the labor movement and the glory of people like John L. Lewis and, oh, my God, just go down the list. All the labor leaders who had struggled to build a middle class in this country. When I was a kid on Labor Day, there were marches all around Toledo. Oh, my God, there were flags and drums and high school bands and horns and bugles and military contingents. And just about every working stiff in Toledo marched with his union group and World War II veterans. And I mean, you know, it's just celebrating the fact that unions had created a middle class in this country. Only unions. Members of Congress made it a little bit easier for the organizing part of it. But it was only the unions, only the working people who were willing to get out there in the streets of America and die, be gunned down, beaten, hanged, burned to death in order to establish a middle class. But about 10 years ago, it just started to occur to me, what's the point? There is no union movement in this country anymore other than the public unions, and they're pretty much restricted by state or federal budgets. There are budget constraints. That's why the public unions would take deferred payments. They're called pensions, or they're called retirement plans, or they're called health insurance. You know, they would take deferred compensation in order to stay in the public sector rather than taking their skills to the private sector. And then, of course, they had their throats cut. So history repeats itself, first as farce, then as tragedy. Or do I have it backwards? First as tragedy, then as farce. Doesn't matter. So Robert Reich says Labor Day is traditionally time for picnics and parades, but this year's no picnic for American workers, and a protest march would be more appropriate than a parade. And he points out something that we talk about in this program, not only are 25 million Americans unemployed or underemployed, but American companies continue the bloodletting. They continue to cut wages, cut benefits, hoard their money. The median wage is still dropping. It has been since the mid-70s. And high unemployment, you see, has given employers extra bargaining leverage to wring out wage concessions. This is one of the underlying principles of capitalism. You ever heard that expression that if unemployment gets down around 3.5-4%, is considered full employment? Do you ever wonder what does that mean? You know, if 4% of the workforce, if 4 out of every 100 people who want a job can't get one, that's considered full employment. That's to keep that pool of unemployed workers at the very bottom, right down the bottom of the ladder. So if you get, you know, you get some unions, you get some people who get a little bit too uppity, you just fire them and bring in the scabs. And it's terrible to call unemployed workers scabs. But if they're not unionized and they do step in and take a union person's job, then I guess they are scabs, right? Instead of parades Monday week, Robert Reich says there ought to be demonstrations. Well, there's a radical idea.
Doing talk radio right from the left, it's Mike Malloy.
Five before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Clark Morgan. Thanks, Clark. Robert Reich says, all told, it's been the worst decade for American workers in a century. According to Commerce Department data, private sector wage gains over the last decade have even lagged behind wage gains during the decade of the Great Depression. Can you believe that? 4% over the last 10 years, adjusted for inflation, versus 5% from 1929 to 1939. How about that? And the big American corporations are making more money, creating more jobs outside the United States than in it. Huh? What should we do to those corporations? Anybody got any ideas? American children, 1 in 6 people in this country are now receiving food stamps. 1 in 4 American children is dealing with not enough food or the proper food because of this. Our infrastructure is crumbling. Jobs are gone. What should we do to the CEOs of these massive capitalist organizations that have decided to take advantage of workers in other countries where $3 a day is appreciated? And so they leave the U.S. and take the jobs with them. Companies that were built by the sweat of American workers. Well, what do we do with them? Anybody got any ideas? What do you do with people like that? Do you ignore them? Do you try to be like them? Do you just sit back and curse them? What do you do? What do you do? Now, if it were a foreign invader, we would know what to do. If a foreign invader came here and started destroying, our factories, stealing the machinery out of our factories that we used to use to produce stuff, tampering with our food supply, jacking up the prices artificially so that they, the invader, could make money, jacking up the price of gasoline and fuel desperately needed to run the whole shebang. If a foreign invader do that, we know what we would do. We would kill them. We would wage either open warfare or guerrilla warfare against them, and we would kill them. or die trying, because they would be an invader, and they had come into our country, and they were destroying everything, and they were causing our children to go hungry, and our breadwinners to commit suicide, and nervous breakdowns among our population as people realized that they were having everything they owned stolen from them. All of a sudden, their houses weren't worth a damn thing. All of a sudden, they couldn't get financing. The credit card interest rates were over the top because these invaders had come in and changed everything. What would we do? We would kill them, wouldn't we? Wouldn't we? I think we would. I know I would if somebody invades my country. As much as I am a pacifist, I'm not a moron. If somebody invades my country, my neighborhood, my house, I will kill them. It's very simple. Once I ascertain that that person is there to do me severe harm and maybe kill my family and kill me, what am I going to do? Sit there and chant kumbaya? I don't think so. That's when I pick up a weapon and defend myself. How do I defend myself? I kill the invader or die trying. Right? I mean, isn't that basic evolutionary law? Isn't it? Huh? I think so. Unless something changed. Unless our DNA has all of a sudden, or our genetic structure has said, no, just sit here and die. So, Robert Reich says CEO pay has soared, going way up, while the working people in this country are plunging deeper into a hole. You know, I'll tell you something, too, Seeger. Eventually, the hole is going to be so deep we can't get out of it. I keep talking about what's it going to take. What is the tipping point? At what point do we say, okay, that's enough, and start to resist and fight back? And I mean seriously resist. I mean seriously fight back. At what point do we do that? If you are, say, 5'10", and you're in a hole that is 6 feet deep, you can still get out. 6.5 feet, you can get out. 7 feet, you can get out. 8 feet, it's going to be a little struggle. 10 feet, somebody throw you a rope. 12 feet, 20 feet. At some point, the hole gets deep enough that you can't get out. And you know what happens then? They start shoveling the dirt in on top of you, and that's the end of that. The ratio of corporate profits to wages, you know, what the capitalists make and what you and I make, is now higher than at any time since just before the Great Depression. Huh? Meanwhile, our economy has stopped growing. In large part because consumers, and remember, the buyers, the consumers, provide 70% of gross domestic product. 70%. But the consumers are also workers whose jobs and wages are disappearing. How deep does a hole have to get? 12 feet? 12 and a half feet? 13? 13 and a half? How deep before we can't crawl out? Huh? Reich says, so let's bag the picnics and parades this Labor Day. American workers should march in protest. They're getting the worst deal they've had since before Labor Day was invented. And the economy is suffering as a result. And as the economy suffers, the society suffers, the political system suffers, the culture suffers, the educational system suffers, the infrastructure, everything. Everything is going to hell. Is anybody, you know, a little bit later on tonight, I'm going to talk about that. I ran into this very interesting piece written by the editorial director of, are you ready? Variety. The Hollywood publication? I'll get to that later tonight. But Robert Reich is right. Big American corporations are making more money and creating more jobs than ever before, except they're all outside the U.S. So what do we do? Got lots of options, lots of ways to respond to someone, a foreigner, of course, coming into your country, your state, your society, your workforce, your home, your child's mind, and destroying everything. You just sit back and say, okay, I'm helpless. I can't do anything. No. If it were a foreign invader, well, what would we do? Would we just sit back while the invader did all the damage? Or would we fight?
That's quite a questioner, Malloy.
Last night I had shared this piece with you, guy who was on was it Delta Continental? Are those the two airlines that are merging? Who is merging?
Oh, I don't know.
I told you about the guy who was on the airplane reading a book on aircraft from the World War One, World War Two era, and black guy, and what happened to him? The flight stopped at the end of the end of the runway just prior to takeoff. Went back to the gate. All kinds of authorities came on board, took him off the plane, wanted to know why in the hell he was reading that book, and then they let him back on. Well, I got an email here from John in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'll share that with you when we come back from the break. Also, Prairie 2 tonight, and your phone calls. The lines are open, by the way, if you want to call in, 877-996-2556. And did you, you know, you talk about, you know how these religious crazy sons of bitches and these right-wingers talk about how gay marriage would destroy heterosexual marriage. You know, the Bible Belt is known for its devotion to traditional values, right? Southerners don't do so well. One key family value, they're more likely to get divorced than people living in the Northeast. You know, there's not a state down here that where gay marriage is legal, but the divorce rate here is higher than in any other part of the country. Maybe it's all that Christ talk. You think? Maybe it's what? What, Kathy?
The methamphetamines.
The methamphetamines. Maybe that's it. A family demographer of the U.S. Census Bureau and co-author of this new report says in the South there are higher rates of marriage and higher rates of divorce for men and women. In the Northeast, you have people who are delaying first marriages. Consequently, there are lower rates of marriage and lower rates of divorce. Yeah, down here, if a young woman is 15 years old and she's not married or pregnant or both, somebody in the family says, oh, damn, we failed, didn't we? We'll be right back.
They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within. I'm coming now. I'm coming to reward them.
Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. All right, we're going to get your calls here in just a minute. If you're on hold, stay there. I'll come to you in a second. Regarding marriage and all the other crap, and I mean the way it's reported by the right-wingers, I don't think marriage is crap. I think everybody ought to have a shot at it once or twice, maybe three times. Doesn't make any difference what your orientation is. You know, it could be a lot of fun. It could be hell on earth, too. But I get this from Bob. He says, Mike, some things are just delicious. Just think of all those fundies with iPads, iPhones, iPods, and Apple computers that will now just wet their pants because they own a product from a company that will now be headed by a gay CEO. Yeah, Steve Jobs is getting out of the business, and his replacement happens to be a gay man. Bob goes on, just look at Apple's trademark. A rainbow apple. That alone must have wadded up a few fundy bloomers in the past. But little did they know that the father of the modern computer was Alan Turin. T-U-R-I-N. You can look him up if you want to. Alan, A-L-A-N, Turin, another gay man, who just happened to save the world from fascism by deciphering the Enigma code and helping to destroy the German U-boat fleet. I can just see Pat Robertson and the rest of these religious loons burning their iPhones. You gotta love it. You gotta love it. You gotta love it. Oh, man. This hour has been sponsored by Clark Morgan. Thank you, Clark. And there is no message, just the sponsorship. Thanks, Clark. From John in Raleigh. Mike, I heard this via recording today, Thursday, that man and millions of Americans have already begun to experience the new America. He's referring to the guy we told you about last night who was taken off the aircraft and then allowed to go back on. We citizens have totally lost the initiative, and our government is locking us down more and more, using laws and personal intimidation. That passenger was humiliated in front of a plane load of passengers. He got the message, but had he become angry, challenging, or tried to use his cell phone to call his senator or congressman, he'd have been phoning his story to you from a cell, and he'd likely have been put on a no-fly list, just for good measure. Our government and its institutions have figured out how to use targeted individual intimidation as a tool to get the word out that citizen rights no longer matter, off the table. I've seen bumper stickers that say, legalize freedom and legalize the Constitution. Sums it up intellectually, but so far not enough Americans have run out of denial and money and food and work, so on it goes, and so it goes. I'd love to hear from someone who can tell us about Germany in the 20s and 30s, how it came to be that Hitler rose to power, and what was it about the American mind or the German mind and intellect that allowed it. We're going along the same path. In America today, all citizens are viewed as the minority and as potentially dangerous by our government. There was a line in an episode of the reimagined Battlestar Galactica series where Admiral Adams told the president why he would not use his military in civil or civilian situations. Quote, "The military protects the state and the police serve the people. But when the military becomes the police, it often happens that the people become the enemy." End quote. This is where we are now, and Americans, so entitled, so much in denial, are not seeing this emerging tyranny on the local and national level for what it is, a coup. We've got a political coup in progress, and a corporate coup in progress. Anyone care? John in Raleigh. Yeah, John. Mike is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hello, Mike.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm a white Christian conservative. Can't be Republican. I used to consider myself Republican, but I can't.
Mike, hold on a second. I'm getting about every other word you're saying. Are you on a set? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm on a cell.
Yeah, that's all right, but all right, let's try again. Start again, if you would.
Okay, I'm a white Christian conservative. I can't consider myself a Republican anymore.
Why not?
Not after McCain.
Yeah?
I don't know. It's just they're not where the answer lies, in my viewpoint.
Where would you place yourself, then, at this point, politically?
See, politically, I don't know. I guess I'm looking for somebody that, and that's probably my problem, is that I'm looking for somebody that can change things around, but, you know, not any one man can do it. You know, we have a lot of problems in this country, and I'm sure you probably feel, I mean, you talk about businesses shipping their jobs overseas.
Right.
And, you know, there's some businesses that should not be allowed to get away with that.
That's true.
But there's some, that's the only option today. You know, you got first quarters. They just went out of business.
Right.
It's tough to do business here. And so I'm wondering, you know, I mean, there's not any one fix. There's not any one, you know, string or pull to fix this problem. It's got to be a whole mess of things.
Let me ask you, you said it's tough to do business here. Why do you think that's true?
Well, I know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. He said his company, he gets paid, I think he said about 29 bucks an hour.
Uh-huh.
But it costs his company about 47 bucks an hour to employ him.
You lost me. I'll tell you what, Mike, hold on. Let me put you on hold because I'd like to hear some more of what you got to say. And if you're in the car, maybe you'll get to a better cell. So don't hang up, Mike. We'll come to you as soon as we come back from this break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour two of the Malloy program tonight. We're talking with Mike in Charlotte, North Carolina. All right, Mike, where were we?
All right.
You said,
I'm driving back towards town, so hopefully I got some signal.
Yeah, you said you have a friend who makes 20-something an hour, but his employer says what?
Well, he makes about 29 an hour,
okay,
which is good money, but it costs his employer something like 40-something an hour to employ him.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, yeah, you know what? There are companies that can probably keep their jobs here, and they probably should.
Well, let me ask you, did he tell you why it cost his employer an extra 21 bucks an hour to keep your friend employed?
There's paying him.
Mm-hmm.
There's his job is, of course, I'm not against union. His job is unionized, so that's, you know, one of the things about he gets good money. Because of that, but like I said, I'm not against you. It also is equipment.
Well,
that goes out with
the equipment. Well, any company has to provide equipment for the worker, and as far as being unionized, that's not an add-on expense. I mean, whatever the union bargains with the employer as pay, that's what the employer pays.
I mean, I know, but I'm going to say without the union, he'd probably be making, you know.
Well, that may be, but it sounds to me that you're arguing two points here. You're bringing up two points. You said that this guy makes $29 an hour, but his employer has to spend, let's say, $40 an hour to keep him employed. That has nothing to do with the union. Where's that extra $21 coming, or the extra $19 coming from?
Well, the point I'm trying to make is
Or extra $11, really. What am I saying?
The point I'm making is it costs some companies here a lot of money. The companies that do keep their jobs there, it costs them a lot of money to operate.
Well, no, I get that. I'm trying to get you to tell me, if you can, where that difference, that $11 difference is. If your friend makes 29 bucks an hour and he says that employer spends 40 an hour, where's the other 11 going? That's all I'm asking you.
Well, like I said, it's paying for the equipment that he has to go out and use.
Well, you're going to have to have equipment, whether you're union or not union, whether the job is in the United States or in Russia. I mean, you still have to have the equipment.
Oh yeah, but that's like the total cost for him operating.
Okay, well, you're losing me because that doesn't sound like a problem. I mean, if you have a business and you're paying somebody $29 an hour, Mike, and you have to come up with another $11 an hour to give him the tools to do his job, you'd have to provide those tools even if you move your factory to China. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't see where the problem is here. I mean,
well, I'm just trying to point out that I'm just trying to point out that it costs money, a lot more money than it would be they pay.
Okay, look, let me put it to you this way: the cost of the machinery or the tools. That cost is probably going to be the same no matter where the employer goes. The difference, I think, is in the wage that's paid. Your friend makes $29 an hour. This company he works for could move everything to China and pay somebody $1 an hour. And that's what's happening. So it's not that the company can't operate in the United States. It is that the company looks at the wage differential and says, why should I pay an American worker $29 an hour, your friend, when all I have to do is move my operation to China? I can pay $1 an hour.
Okay.
So the add-on costs, now you may be talking about stuff like workman's compensation and unemployment insurance that employer has to pay and FICA matching that goes to Social Security. Maybe your friend's employer provides health insurance instead of his union. You get all this kind of stuff. You know how to eliminate that?
How?
Single-payer health care. That's all. What Obama, I thought Obama was going to try to do, which he didn't. He came up with some half-witted plan that just put more money into the pockets of the insurance companies. But it damn sure isn't socialism, what Obama came up with. So, and besides, all that extra cost, that extra $11 an hour that we're talking about here, if you just forget the FICA tax and unemployment, forget all that. That extra $11 you just pass through to the person that buys the product. I mean, if you buy a hammer made in China, it'll cost you, for the sake of argument, $1. If you buy the same hammer built here, same material to build, it's going to cost you $5. Why?
Okay.
Why? Because the wage cost in China is so low. So we have factories here that used to make hammers, but they don't anymore. Because the hammer maker knew that he could make a lot more profit if he moved to China and said, to hell with the American worker. Just to hell with the American worker. So that's what happened. That's why we're in this situation. And you know whose fault this was? Two people, George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton. Because what did they do? They signed off on NAFTA, which allowed jobs to go out of this country. Supposed to go to Mexico. NAFTA stands for North American Free Trade Agreement. Canada, United States, and Mexico. We're going to have no tariffs. Everything's going to be fine. So what happened? The corporations decided, well, hell, if we can get this work done. Now, the Canadians aren't going to work for $2 an hour. The Mexicans would. But once they got to Mexico, the employers realized, well, hell, we can go on to China and get the same work for $1 an hour. Zing! Off they went. So, you have something to tell your friend now, all right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still having businesses that are struggling to make, local guys. I could go and employ myself.
Uh-huh.
I would have to come up with something for people to buy that are people going to want to buy.
Right.
But still, at what point do I break into, I can employ somebody? Getting to that point is going to be rough.
Well,
people
aren't
hiring, obviously. People cannot hire. People can't afford to hire. And if they hire, they're going to go broke.
You're losing me there. If I have a chicken farm and I'm raising chickens, and all of a sudden I need to hire somebody to help me gather the eggs, that's because I'm producing more eggs, which means I'm getting more money coming in, which I then turn around and pay the worker. I don't understand what you're talking about. You lost me, Mike. If a company is being successful. In other words, most small companies that start out, a lot of them start out with a couple of women or a couple of men or maybe a husband or wife. They put together a company out in the garage. And the next thing you know, they hire a third person and then maybe a fourth and then a fifth. But they don't hire unless they're making a profit. And they don't make a profit, as you pointed out, unless people are buying the product. So that has nothing, but that has nothing to do with not being able to afford to start a business.
So I guess my question is there, with some of these companies that have the jobs empty, if they bring it back over, are they going to still be able to turn a profit?
They could, but it won't be enough to satisfy the greed. Look, these companies, Mike, I'm going to put you on hold, then I'm going to go here because we're coming up on a break. But it was never about these companies not being able to afford to operate in the United States. I mean, if somebody's telling you that, look them in the eye and say you're a liar. The reason the companies moved was because they could make more profit. That's called greed. They didn't want to stay in the United States where everything was fine. You know, you had a middle class, you had a unionized labor force or not, but people were making money, products were being bought, everything was rocking along pretty good. And then the parting gift that Clinton gave the United States was NAFTA, it came in the middle of his term, his 8 years, but it took a while for corporate America to realize, hey, this is a ticket out of here. So that's what they did. But anyway, Mike, no, anybody who gives a thought and works out a budget can start a business. Whether or not they succeed, I don't think has anything to do with anything other than will people buy the product. That's all. Thanks, Mike. I enjoyed your call. Appreciate you checking in, man. Take care.
Up America, one flying monkey at a time. Here's Mike Malloy.
Sweet. 21 past the hour. I want to get to Prairie 2's missive here. Let's do it right now. If you're on hold, I'll come to you in a moment. Under the subject line, hot stock tip, Prairie 2 writes, Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, has just made a really shrewd move, or he really is nuts. He was recently vilified by the right for suggesting that people who make over $1 million a year should start paying 35% income tax instead of the current 15%. His new questionable investment was to put $5 billion into Bank of America, the biggest of the big zombie banks. This pulls Bank of America back from the edge of the cliff and then some. You might say he thought buying a stock that has lost 50% of its value was just an ordinary buying opportunity. But you might say that the rumor that came out about what that... Prairie 2, I'll tell you, some of you are saying, but you might say that the rumor that just came out about what that big new jobs program Obama is going to introduce in September has something to do with it. I hope that sentence makes sense. The most successful capitalist in the world did President Obama a real solid by taking a principled stance against greedy right-wingers. Did Obama return the favor with a hot stock tip? Or is Buffett just really smart? The secret plan to revive the economy, if rumors are to be believed, is to finally refinance all the outstanding mortgages to the new low interest rate, which currently is less than 4%. And by the way, let me digress. This is a great idea. This would immediately start pumping cash into the economy, which, when fully implemented, would amount to $85 billion a year and would be a high-grade stimulus. This would continue for a generation until these loans are paid off. The real kicker is that Congress can't stop Obama from doing this. And it won't cost anything. Obama already has the authority to do this from laws passed in 2009. Warren Buffett and Bank of America could benefit from the rewriting of the loans if they're allowed to do the paperwork. And if nothing else, it should take care of that trillion in bad mortgages Bank of America has on its books. Why didn't Obama do this before? Well, it's going to really piss off those greedy millionaires and billionaires that Buffett has been publicly shaming. You need to understand about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the government-backed semi-private home loan holding companies, the ones that the right-wingers want to privatize, which really means steal. You see, these companies have issued trillions of housing bonds that pay pretty good interest and are government-backed, even if no longer AAA. The rich people who hold these Freddie and Fannie bonds are suddenly going to have them redeemed, and they won't have any place to put their ill-gotten gains that pays anything. Not that these people are going to starve, but they might need to invest in something productive for a change. These high-interest bonds were simply an instrument for the rich lords to tax the peasants, and the rich didn't pay any significant tax themselves as dividends. Interest and capital gains are taxed at a maximum of 15%. This kind of income is completely exempt from payroll taxes as well. Not just the amount over $106,000. So while the self-employed Mercedes mechanic will pay 47% federal tax, including 12% for FICA, on the top slice of his income, the guy who has his chauffeur bring the car in will sit home by the pool and whine about paying 15%, not counting other tax loopholes. The response from the right? But the rich pay more than half the income tax, and to be fair, we need to tax the bottom 48% to pay any taxes. They don't mention the rich. We're talking thousands of people compared to 150 million who don't pay. The rich have more than half of the income as well. Plus, the personal income tax only accounts for 44% of revenue, while FICA is 41%, and FICA is not paid by the rich. The rich pay about half of the actual income tax rate they paid in 1961. The rich also benefit greatly from their ownership of massive corporations that provide them with all manner of lavish perks and the ability to wield raw power. No problem getting the 50-yard line seats for the big game with the company name on the stadium and fly to the game on the corporate jet with the private five-star chef. No problem getting George into Yale instead of trying to get him on at the sheltered workshop. And those criminal charges can just go away when the judge owes you his job. Corporations in the U.S. pay the lowest actual tax rate in the developed world, and it's about a quarter of what they paid 50 years ago. It's good to be rich. It sucks for you, teabagger. PrairieNumeral2.com. Go to his website and tell him to ungarble some of his sentences so that your humble and obedient servant, Malloy, here can read the damn things. We'll be back after the break.
dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. What? Somebody says I'm running Walmart ads? I'm not running Walmart ads. Look, you folks have to understand something, okay? I get emails like this every once in a while. I have no idea what commercials are run by the affiliated stations that take this program. I have nothing to do with those stations. I have no idea what commercials XM Radio or Sirius Satellite Radio, what they run. I have no connection to XM and Sirius. The only thing these radio stations do is to carry the program. That's it. We don't have any commercial agreement. If you're listening online and you hear commercials coming from here, those are ones that are run by my syndicator, which is Dial Global. But I have nothing to do whatsoever. So if you hear, come election time, these local stations will be running political ads for right-wing teabag Republicans as well as Democrats. But that has nothing, while my program is on, it has nothing to do with me. So come on, folks. It's about the fifth time I've explained this. I have no idea. On my website, occasionally you'll see an ad for something that I am absolutely opposed to. That's a Google ad. It just pops up and then it's gone. I don't control that either. So take a deep breath and understand that, no, you haven't caught me in some act of hypocrisy. I have nothing to do with the ads that are sold around this program on various radio stations. Thank you very much. Where were we? Mark, thanks for holding on, Mark.
Not a problem, Mike.
In San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hi.
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Yeah, listen, I wanted to bring up about these teabag freak congressmen that have been out on vacation and they won't even face their constituents. They're refusing to hold town hall meetings because of the fact they've sold out America and they're just traitors. And, you know, Robert Rice says that labor should have a demonstration or put on demonstrations. I agree with him. But there's going to be a fight coming up with these teabag freaks in Congress about the FAA funding. And they're going to refuse to fund it unless they can get, legislation to make it hard for the FAA to form a union.
Mm-hmm.
That is a battle. And, you know, enough's enough. These people signed a pledge for Grover Norquist, to Grover Norquist, and not the United States of America. They signed their souls to a man that is out for greed and corporations,
mm-hmm.
and turned their back on America.
That's right.
These are traitors, Mike.
Of course they are. Of course they are. And you know what I heard today? That, you know, this hurricane that is heading for the U.S., and if it does hit the mainland in the Northeast, there's going to be some damage that nobody can really calculate right now. And what I've heard on one of the TV talk shows is that Eric Cantor and the rest of these slime bastards from the Republicans are saying they're starting to drop in, so they're not going to appropriate money for emergency work after this hurricane hits unless there is an equal amount cut from the federal budget. Now, at that point, I would think that this country would explode into a revolt.
Well, you know, Mike, the Republican Party put the 99ers out of work. Their policies, their George Bush, put all these people out of work. Then now these people are being ridiculed by the Republicans. They want to cut all the programs that we need right now because of what the Republicans did. We have a Democratic Party that won't stand up to these rats,
mm-hmm.
who put us in this position. And say, hey, you owe these people. You did it to these people. Nothing. They didn't go after Bush for the war crimes. They didn't go after the banksters. They didn't go after Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they just put the middle class out there, and the Republicans are hammering us. And
there's
nobody, standing up for us. And it's to me that this situation with being held hostage by the teabag freaks and the Republicans, it's gone far enough. If labor is going to do anything, if the people that are out of work are pissed off, then they ought to be there when the Republican congressmen come back and have a party for them, because they're running for their constituents. But we ought to be waiting for them, Mike.
I hear that loud and clear, Mark. And like I've said a million times, at some point, unless we are all spineless and brain dead in this country and have no courage, no guts, no nothing, at some point, we're going to say enough. And when that point comes, there's going to be hell to pay. There's going to be hell
to
pay.
And you know, Mike, the fact is that these people were willing to, you know, have the American economy go right down the tubes in the name of greed because they wanted to make sure that the rich didn't have to pay any more taxes. Now, this is what it's come to, Mike, this kamikaze-type politics. And it's not going to stop till there's a vicious, strong response to this type of basic behavior on the part of our Congress and Senate that are Republican.
I hear you loud and clear. Well said. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate
okay,
what you had to say. All right, take care. Take care. Scary stuff. No, I think I'll bring this up tomorrow. Yeah, I'll do that tomorrow. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be talking like you're not there. John in Raleigh writes, Mike, IBM, my old company, used to tell us that on top of our salary, they paid an average of another $15,000 per year for medical benefits, retirement accounts, etc. This is in regard to the caller from Charlotte. Then they had what management called a burden rate per employee that was related to taxes, the cost of keeping the building open and heated and air conditioned and maintenance, all that stuff. But they never told employees about the burden rate. Although in the Northeast U.S., for example, it was more expensive than in the South or Southwest. We used to have yearly department meetings about how much the company paid for medical retirement accounts. And we're told that this was money we didn't see in our pay, but that the company was paying per employee. Both these employee indirect costs and the burden rate is what companies are trying to eliminate or make on par with third world countries compared to the U.S. worker. But two, you have to look at the profit per employee, which, if large enough, should entice the company to be happy to stay in the States. But it is not enough. And so it goes. John. Yeah, you know, what about the productivity of the worker? Was it Michael and Roswell sent me an email about that. They're not considering the productivity. Productivity of the American worker has gone up almost exponentially, while the corporate profits are just out of just in the stratosphere. And since the productivity has gone up, you know, more widgets are produced by the same amount of worker. Why hire more workers to produce more widgets? Just threaten the worker. The worker's not unionized. There's no collective bargaining agreement. He knows his ass is on the line. He knows if he screws up once, or she, if the worker screws up one time, he or she knows that the job is going to disappear at the whim of the company. Hey, you're out of here. Why? What'd I do? Nothing. You're out of here. We're just going in a different direction. Goodbye. But worker productivity in the past, 25 years, has never been an issue. This is the galling part. This is the part that, if you look deep enough into these issues, will drive you to start ripping out your hair or somebody's hair or doing something in reaction. It's not the American worker who screwed up. It's the capitalist, the American capitalist, who has said, you know, we've bled these sons of bitches dry. We've never sat on more cash than what we're sitting on now. But you know what? It's not enough. It's never enough. That's the thing about greed. That's the thing. That's why it's one of the so-called seven deadly sins. I mean, it is. That's what Jesus warned against. That's why the Christian evangelicals are, for the most part, fascists, because they will tell you, oh, greed is good. Jesus wants you to be wealthy. Jesus wants the capital gains tax eliminated. You know, that kind of garbage, crap, nonsense. So, but worker productivity? Nah. The most efficient workers on earth are right here. And as far as the so-called industrialized nations, the worker here is the one that gets the worst deal. So at what point do you think, seriously, at what point do you think the formerly middle class and former working people in this country will finally realize that their strength far exceeds that of these corporate pigs and raise up with one big fist and bring it down? Scott is in Wyoming, listening on Sirius. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Try to get organized at the end of my day here.
Uh-huh.
I'm fed up with all the politicians.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I said I'm fed up with all of the politicians.
Right, I hear that.
And it started with George Bush.
Uh-huh.
I thought he lied for his reasons to go into Afghanistan. I would have had more respect for him had he said, hey, the guy put a $2 million price tag on my dad. I'm going to go get him. I would have respected that.
You mean in Iraq?
In Iraq, yes. I said Afghanistan, didn't I?
Yeah.
It's been a long day.
That's all right.
So, yes, I've been in Iraq. So, had he said that, I would have agreed and said, yeah, okay, somebody puts a $2 million bounty on somebody in my family, I'd want to go get them.
But now, wait a second, Scott. Would you agree with the idea, supposing George Bush would have been that honest, would you have agreed to send hundreds of thousands of young American men and women into a war zone just to satisfy your own crazed revenge lust? I don't think I'd go along with that at all. Now, if George Bush, if he wanted to strap on a couple of six-shooters and take a rifle, or the best that the military could give him, and suit him up and drop him in downtown Baghdad with a sign that says, where are you, you son of a bitch, Saddam? That I could agree with.
Well, and that's what I would have said. You know, you
right.
Send in take him out.
Right, but to cause a war where thousands of...
No, I would not have agreed with the war.
Yeah, thousands of Americans...
I felt like he had lied. I felt like Barack Obama was lying when he made the comment, a change we can believe in, because...
Right. Well, sure.
Government doesn't change fast. So to think that we're going to see a change, and I honestly believe one of the things he said was that he was going to cut spending, and he hasn't. He's found new ways to spend. I hate the fact of spending as much on welfare as we do when those guys can go out and do drugs and drink all they want.
Scott, wait a second. You're getting too far out in the ozone for me. Let me just ask you a question. And see if you can give me an answer here, because I'm asking seriously. I'm testing you. This is a test. What part of the U.S. federal budget goes for these welfare programs? Give me a percentage.
Oh, I believe it's less than 1%.
Okay. If that's the case, and actually it's a little bit more than that, but if that's the case, then how is welfare... where are you going to cut these spending programs? If your number's right, where are you going to cut it?
Okay. You take all these things that are, you know, a 1% here, 1% there, 1% here, and put slashes on all of them. Cut them out.
Well, no, I have a better idea. Let me tell you my idea, Scott. About 60%, I think that's the latest figure, about 60% of the cash that the government takes in taxes goes to support the war machine in this country, the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned us about. How about we start cutting there?
Well, as long as the cuts made there are intelligent, then yes. But
I don't think you need intelligence. All you need is a huge axe. I mean, who is going to attack the United States? We have, I forget what the last number is, I think we have 6,000 or 7,000 deliverable nuclear warheads. What moron is going, what state? Now, I'm not denying that there are terrorists like the Saudis that attacked us, if you want to believe the official story, but what country is going to attack the United States? Nobody attacks us. We had some terrorists come here 10 years ago and commit an act of multiple murder. But nobody attacks us. In fact, Scott, we attack other people. I mean, that's what we do. Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia. We're the ones who do the attacking. Nobody attacks us. Who's going to attack us? Mexico?
Afghanistan, that's where Al-Qaeda was at the time, according to what we're being told.
Well, according to what we're being told. But if we believe that, why didn't we send in, some of these SEAL team members and take them out? What have we heard? That there are about 50 of them in Afghanistan? How many troops do we have there? 100,000? And besides, the money to support those Al-Qaedas or whatever they are, that money was provided by George Bush's business partners, the Saudis who support them. And how do the Saudis get the money? Because people like you and me, we continue to buy gasoline. Why do we buy gasoline? Because apparently you and I are not smart enough yet to figure out that the oil companies continue to put us in this bind where we have to send money to people who come over here and bomb us, when all we have to do is to get some smart technology. Well, you see where I'm going with this. It just goes round and round, Scott. And frankly, I'm tired of chasing my own tail. You know what I'm saying? I feel like one of those clown dogs in a cartoon that just keeps going round, round, round in a circle. Scott, thanks, man. I got a boogie. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
7 past the hour. A little bit more on the Joe Schneiderman, or not Joe. Why do I make up these names? I did this last night too, making up people's names. Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, was calling Robert Gates last night. Bill Gates. Wrong Gates. Anyway, get to that in a second. Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina, you know, the guy that screamed out, "You lie," at Obama back in 2009 during a joint session of Congress. Was that? I don't think it was State of the Union, was it? Don't remember. But Joe Wilson from the Peanut Gallery screamed out, "You lie." He has gone to the hospital in Columbia, South Carolina. I wonder if he went to the one, Kathy, where Chris was working. Wouldn't that be funny? Hospital in South Carolina because of an extended fever. Wilson's office, in a short statement yesterday, said Joe Wilson was admitted. Statement contained no other details, including when the congressman was admitted, if he remained in the hospital, or the name of the hospital. Wilson's office said last week that he was taking antibiotics to treat symptoms of Lyme disease. Got bitten by a tick? Wouldn't that be appropriate, huh? After making his remark, "You lie!" I'm surprised he didn't say, "You lie!" and then use the N-word. That would have been more in keeping with what comes out of South Carolina. Well, it's true. Members of the Republican bag party, that's just a normal way of talking. But after he made that shout out, he got campaign donations from across the country. His campaign, his reelection campaign till just filled up. Everybody thought he was just being such a hero. "You lie!" "Oh, we love you, Joe. You tell that, you know. You tell that, you know, the president." He now regularly appears on Fox, and of course, he's a sought-after guest at Republican fundraisers. What has Joe Wilson done his entire life that warrants his being sought after for Republican fundraisers regarding politics to better his fellow citizens? Nothing. But you know, he told the colored guy to shut up. And you know, when you sit in a huge clutch of strange-looking, brain-dead, religiously fanatical white guys and scream at the black guy up at the podium, "Shut up! You lie!" That makes you famous, right? I usually don't pay very much attention whatsoever to Variety, the Hollywood trade publication, Variety, except in old movies. You know, on Turner Network Television, TNT, where they play the classic movies from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s even, sometimes the 60s, but especially the film noir flicks. And they'll do a sequence sometimes. It'll show, you know, in black and white, it'll show a front page of Variety and then headlines screaming from the page of Variety. It has something to do with the plot of the movie. That was about my only exposure with Variety until they finally went online years ago. And then occasionally, you know, I'd go there and read some of the Hollywood. The Hollywood news. Oh, my God. You talk about a bubble completely separate from the rest of the universe. But I digress. I just don't go there. But at Huffington Post today, they had a piece by Peter Bart, who is the vice president and editorial director of Variety. And he entitled it America's Numb Generation. And what he's asking is whether or not our kids, who
are marching or soon will march off to school or college in the coming days, he says a nagging question presents itself. And this is how he phrases it. Why are they so goddamn calm? Or are they numb? Yeah, right there, the GD word. In the the first sentence by the editorial director of Variety. Holy Toledo, what is happening in this country where people can use the GD word like that? I mean, come on. Oops. Or are they numb? He wants to know. He says that he realizes kids occupy their own little world. They do. Oh, trust me. If you have children or nieces and nephews, you know what I'm talking about. They, no matter what age group, we have the exquisite pleasure of having a seven-year-old. And she and her best friend are so far into their own little world, they're trying to figure out how they're going to deal with perhaps going to separate colleges a decade from now. You know, it's just crucial, critical. Molly sits around and tries to figure out, well, if Shrita goes to this college and I don't, So you talk about being, and that's a good thing. You know, little kids being insulated, living in their own little world, that's wonderful. Because can you imagine a 7 or a 10 or a 12-year-old trying to cope with what's going on? That's why that story on ABC last night was just a heartbreaker for me. It just destroyed me. Absolutely, they always do. The stories about kids who are living in families where there is no food. So you have some children, like Molly and Shrita, who are worried if they will be separated when they both go to college someday. And on the other hand, you have children who are upset because they know that at the end of the month, when the food stamp allotment is run out, there will be no food in the fridge. And that mom doesn't eat so the kids themselves can eat. Now, a lot of people listen to this program. And moi. I mean, I had situations like that when I was a kid growing up. I really do. I can remember looking in what we called our pantry when I was a kid. And there was a jar of peanut butter. And that's it. I've said on this program before, there was a time when I and my two brothers and sister and parents were on what back in the day we called relief. There was no welfare back then, as it's known today, relief. And we would get government-issued food, eggs, flour, rice, beans, butter. And my mother would make food with that. And, of course, she worked as a waitress, but my old man was unemployed. And stayed unemployed for the better part of a decade. So been there, done that, got the scars. I know what that feels like. Personally, I know. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to go to school in elementary school with your stomach growling. I do know that. I honestly, truthfully do. And I don't wear it as a badge of accomplishment or a badge of courage or a badge of anything. It's just what happened when I was a kid. And it didn't happen our entire lives growing up, my sister and brothers and me, but a goodly enough period of time that it left a real imprint. So when I read about children or see children now, 50 years later, half a century later, and the issue has not been solved, the issue is even worse. And then I hear the politicians talking about taking what little bit these families have away from them. That's when I get into one of my potentially homicidal rages. Because these sons of bitches who talk about that, they've never been there. I have. Maybe you have. A lot of these children have. But I digress. I'll come back to what Peter Bart had to say when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. If you know it ain't over till God says that it's over, come on, come on, come on, let's go. Somebody's we're pulling together when we get it all done. And the world is much brighter. Yeah, I'm walking the rays of the beautiful sun.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So, getting back to what Peter Bart wrote at Huffington Post, he's the vice president, editorial director of Variety, the entertainment publication. He wants to know why America's students, kids, are his words. Why are they so goddamn calm? Or are they numb? He says, I realize they occupy their own little world, but there's a reality. Here's a reality check. Confronting them is a stalled economy and a stalemated government. This translates into big college loans and no job prospects. Well, you know, Peter Bart's asking a legitimate question. What are kids going to do? And I use the term kids advisedly. These are people in their early 20s. Some of them are in their mid-20s. Some in their early 30s still cannot find a job, cannot get the money to pay off student loans, cannot put into the marketplace the skills that they spent 4, 5, 6 years at university to learn. What are they going to do? And Peter Barr says, even more confounding, the young people throughout the rest of the world are far from calm. In fact, they're in a state of revolt. You see where he's going with this. There are riots in London, Israel, Spain, violent demands for change across the long, languid Arab world, North Africa. Just look anywhere you want to. India is about to have some sort of explosion with the man who is attempting to emulate Mohandas Gandhi. If he is still alive, I haven't read anything today. He's in his 9th or 10th day of an absolute hunger strike after his doctors recommended a couple of days ago that he go on a glucose drip or his kidneys were going to be permanently damaged, and he refused. And as a huge surprise to the Indian establishment, the people who are paying attention, responding, gathering as this man commits slow suicide is enormous. And what is he demanding? A focus on the corruption that is the Indian business community, political community, intellectual community, the corruption. Now, this man, Anna is his first name. I'm drawing a blank on his last name. But he's not looked upon favorably by some of the Indian writers and poets that I find knowledgeable and offering insight, like Arundhati Roy, who sees what this man is doing as kind of fascist because he's demanding like a super committee, kind of like the 12 people now in the United States are going to make all the decisions that our legislative branch should make. Anna, to use his first name, sorry, wants to bypass Indian democracy and have some sort of Uber committee also that will make the rules and decide what gets done in India. So that is kind of fascist. We are so close to fascism in this country as to render the term almost neutralized. But India is another story. So all of this is going on all over every place you look. There are student demonstrations in Chile. Are you aware of that? The demonstrations in Chile are about the government raising tuition costs. The Chilean students feel that education should be free. And it should be. All education should be free. Are you kidding me? All education should be without charge, all the way up to and including postdoctoral work. It doesn't make any difference what field. This is something that should be paid for. If we spend $1 trillion on weaponry and death and destruction, why not spend $1 trillion on making sure that every single person in this country, to the extent that they want to, can receive an education all the way from preschool to your doctorate degree and beyond at no cost? Why is there any resistance to that whatsoever? Education. We're talking about education.
Now, there are no limits, none whatsoever, on the amount of money that we spend for death and destruction and ending the human species and ending the planet. But you suggest that education in all its forms should be free, and people just all of a sudden, they stand back and they point at you and they grab their Bibles and they reach for their guns and they say, "You goddamn socialist!" More in a minute.
People gonna rise up. Take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. It's finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about the rest.
Are you concerned?
Standing up to the flying monkey right, it's Mike Malone.
Twenty-five before the hour. So yeah, the whole idea of free education, isn't that just pure socialism? I mean, my God, can you imagine that? If everybody got a free education, why, it would have no value. If it's free, it has no value. Mm-hmm. Wasn't there a time in the not too recent past, say just pre-Reagan governorship of California, that the university system in California, the tuition was practically zero? But anyway, I digress. So Peter Bart, writing at Huffington Post, he is the editorial director of Variety, wants to know what the hell is wrong with the students today. Young people throughout the rest of the world are far from calm. He says that American students are calm, or are they numb? Students around the world are in a state of revolt. And he names several places where that is occurring. And he says in the U.S., by contrast, the only protest last week involved foreign students, not Americans. Remember what we talked about? Students visiting from Turkey and China and Romania and other countries went out on strike, literally, against what started out as a State Department program that was supposed to provide the students, the kids, with free travel and education about the United States, you know, people-to-people kind of stuff. Isn't that funny? And instead, these young people found themselves locked into a factory assembly line in Hershey, Pennsylvania, with long hours, no pay, well, skimpy pay. They're getting $8.25 an hour, and after all the deductions were taken, some of the kids were lucky to wind up with $1 an hour. And as I said last week, I think it was last week, that was a perfect education for students from other countries to get about the United States. It's a perfect education. So the kids decided, the students decided to go out on strike, quote, quote. And they were told they were here on a J-1, I believe it's called a J-1 visa, that says they can come and provide slave labor for these goddamn filthy American capitalist leeches. They won't hire American workers. You know, the Hershey plant used to pay between $18 and $30 an hour for workers. And last time I checked, Hershey has always been very profitable. Huh? $18 to $30 an hour when you consider all the benefits. What do they do now? They get kids that come over for a trip across the United States or within the United States for a couple of months out of the summer and turn them into slave laborers. And the Democratic governor of California has not made up his mind yet whether to pass or sign a bill already passed by both houses of the
California legislature that provides farm workers with a little bit of protection. This is where we live anymore. I mean, this is not Democrat and Republican anymore. The Republicans are all insane. I mean, they are totally goddamn nuts. They're religious fanatics, and they are crazy. And if you locked them all in a room with two or three guns laying around, they would all go for the guns and try to kill each other. They are insane. But the Democrats are cowardly and hypocritical. So the foreign kids were angry and let everyone hear about it. And to the extent that any American young person paid attention, the Americans kind of looked on in awe, Peter Bart says, looked on in silent awe. What? What? They're protesting working conditions? What? What is that about? You mean you can walk off a job? You can protest working conditions? Really? I didn't know that. And the students in Chile and the students in Israel and the students in the UK, they're protesting? They're in the street? Really? Do they have permission to do that? Ooh. Ooh. And then Peter Bart, since he is the editorial director of Variety, he makes what he calls an intriguing footnote that the passivity, as he sees it, of our young people seems to mirror the traits of the characters featured in Hollywood's recent movies. You know, the disoriented stoners in the Hangover sequel, or the losers in Horrible Bosses, or the passive non-aggressives like Steve Carell in Crazy Stupid Love. Even, according to Peter Bart, a couple of the superheroes seem self-doubting, like Ryan Reynolds in Green Lantern. And he says, are young people emulating the traits of the characters they see in the movies or on TV, or is it the other way around? Are the students, young people, become so passive that that's reflected now in the characters in the movies? Who knows? But being the United States, Hollywood has always had kind of a weird parasitic or symbiotic, is that the same thing, relationship with the American public, and the other way around. Do movies reflect us, or we reflect the movies? I mean, right? It's, you know, you can think about that if you want to, if you've got nothing else to do. And he says, none of this is to suggest that taking to the streets is the only effective means to register dissent. See, this is where he cops out. This is where Peter Bart loses what I thought was going to be an editorial statement of young people waking the hell up, doing something, trying to take control of their future by insisting that the present be more productive toward the future. But he drops the ball right here. None of this is to suggest that taking to the streets is the only effective means to register dissent. Well, Mr. Steve Carroll, I would ask you, is there another effective means to register dissent? If there is, can you tell me what it would be? The key word being effective. An email to your senator or your representative? Oh, yeah, that'll work. Now, Steve Carroll, or Peter Bart, I'm sorry, Peter Bart, you should have gone ahead and followed through on what you started to say. The only effective means to register dissent is massive protests in the street. That's what your statement should be, Mr. Peter Bart, not the other way around. But anyway, he goes on to say, those of us who lived through the waves of violence and the assassinations of the 60s fully understand the price paid for these actions. Oh, really? The price paid? What was the price paid? The price paid for the unfulfilled demands of the 60s, using the term 60s in a generic sense, the price paid was nothing happened. Except the national security state became more nationally securitized, and the graft and corruption went on because we didn't follow through in the 60s. We just simply didn't follow through. You can make an argument as to why we didn't. Ran out of energy. Got no support, no backing from the structures that we thought would back us. Just gave up. got lazy, said to hell with it.
I always liked Hunter Thompson's description of the 60s. I think it was in Fear and Loathing, Las Vegas, not Campaign Trail, where he talked about the wave that was rising, the wave in the 60s of the movement that was driven by the young people who were so motivated to see change, and how it rose and rose and it crested, and then it started to recede, and it's been receding ever since. And if you squint your eyes on a hazy day, you can still see the watermark. I always thought that was great, and it was so indicative of how, and even in our protest songs, I mean, there used to be songs about being proactive, and now we have songs that speak to this generation, things like Waiting for the World to Change. Whatever happened to go out and change the world?
Mm-hmm.
That's my question.
Well, you're right. As Peter Bart points out, for perspective, consider the cast of characters who inhabited pop culture in this country in the 60s or 70s, like the protagonists of Easy Rider or Coming Home. Those characters would be totally, even though they're characters, but they would be totally out of sync in today's society. Even The Godfather was about characters building a new parallel power structure, not easing themselves into the established one. So what we have today is a generation that has just been totally numbed out. And I'm not quite sure why. I understand why. I do understand why the toys that are available to what should be the leaders in the student movement, the kids that were 10, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, the toys available that completely short-circuited their ability to get highly pissed off about what they were witnessing. That was one group. Another group, so tired, so hungry, so exhausted because their parents are out of work. They have to move again. The bank is foreclosing. The car has been repossessed. What do you do? What do you do? Another group that is just, as Peter Barr suggests, just totally numbed out, doesn't realize the power of youth. The power that always resides in young people can be used any way. That's why marketers are so intent on redirecting that power away from social change and into consumption. But what is to be consumed now, my fellow young Americans? Not that I'm young, we're Americans. You know, my fellow young Americans, what are you going to consume next? Steve Jobs, the man who invented goddamn near everything you have that's electronic, is about to die. Where's his replacement?
Sometimes.
Before the hour. So what a thing, huh? The editorial director and vice president of Variety, the entertainment world's news bible, writing about America's numb generation. But after laying out his case for taking to the streets, he says none of this is to suggest that taking to the streets is the only effective means to register dissent. I think what Peter Bart is doing here is covering his ass. He is definitely covering his ass. As we mentioned earlier, the Department of Homeland Security is now demanding or is invoking the Patriot Act on Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and everything that entails. So Peter Bard here, I guess anybody who writes, look what happened, or who makes comments, look what happened to Cenk Uygur with his short-lived stint at MSNBC. Because, as Cenk pointed out, he was told by some of the muckety-mucks at MSNBC, that, you know, he wasn't playing on the home team. He was getting a little bit too far out there. So, and he was pissing off the Comcast GE-NBC merger people. So then they hire Reverend Al Sharpton, who was a lobbyist for that merger. Ooh, you didn't know that. So Peter Bard apparently is just covering his behind in saying none of this is to suggest that taking to the streets is the only effective means to register dissent. And then he makes an interesting statement. He said, those of us who lived through the waves of violence and the assassinations of the 60s fully understand the price paid for those actions. What? The price? I mean, the connection there is ludicrous. That the anti-war movement, waves upon waves of hundreds of thousands of millions of people who were demanding an end to violence overseas, as a result of that, Jack Kennedy was shot, Bobby Kennedy was shot, Martin Luther King was shot, George Wallace was shot, Medgar Evers was shot. Peter Bart, I think you need to get a firmer grip on some of these topics before you try to write about them. He says, as a newsman, I personally covered my share of riots and ducked fusillades of bullets. And that was brought about because people were registering dissent in the 60s? Okay, I guess in Peter Bart's experience that, but that just seems to me like, you know, the rooster is very proud of himself because every morning when he crows, he brings up the sun. Kind of an approach. He says, on the other hand, most of us learned to revere the courage displayed during the civil rights movement and even during the protests over Vietnam. The country's mood was energized by protest, not passivity. Okay, that we can agree on that one, Mr. Peter Barr. Absolutely. So where does this leave us today? He writes, well, as parents, perhaps it's time to kick ass, to remind our kids that it takes tough people to survive tough times. Interesting point. Kick our kids' ass. Tell them to go out in the street and demonstrate. What about the parents? What about the rest of us? What about sticking a million people over the age of 40 into the street? What would happen then? How about a million people over the age of 60 into the street? Ooh. Uh-oh. How difficult would it be for the militarized, weaponized police department of a major American city to start using the truncheons on people that look like grandma and grandpa? What kind of a conflict, an internal conflict inside these cops' heads would that set up? Huh? What would you do if you had a million people on the streets establishment and 100,000 of them were in wheelchairs and walkers? What would you do then? There are all sorts of ways once the entire population wakes up, not just as Peter Bart is making the case for waking up young people. What about you, Peter? You covered all this stuff. When was the last time you got arrested in an act of civil disobedience? Or have you never got arrested in an act of civil disobedience? And if not, why not? I don't think that the people Mr. Bart or anybody else references in North Africa or South America or the Middle East or the UK or the EU that are protesting, taking to the streets, I don't think any of those people have any doubt about why they're there. And I don't think it's only young people. I think it's young people and middle-aged people and older people with kids in their arms and people pushing strollers or pushing a wheelchair. Because there comes a point, there comes a tipping point, where the people finally say, that's enough. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.